بسم الله، إن الحمد لله نحمده ونستعينه ونستغفره ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا ومن سيئات أعمالنا، من يهده الله فلا مضل له ومن يضلله فلا هادي له، وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له، وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله. طيب، what did we do yesterday؟ سبحان الذي يسبح الرعد بحمده. What do we do? We define tahara. What is the definition of tahara? Removal of, okay. Spiritual. Okay. We also did what? Utensils, right? We did what? What else? Utensils, we said. Etiquette of restroom. We did wudu, how to do wudu properly. Miswak. Okay. Now today we're going to discuss the factors that break wudu. Also we're going to discuss how to do ghusl and what are the factors that necessitate ghusl. We're going to discuss tayammum, right, which is when you have no water. And if we have time, we're going to discuss women's blood also, menstruation and nifas and others. Okay. So we start off with nawaqid al-wudu, which is the factors that break wudu. And we say that, firstly, there is a big difference of opinion over what are the factors that break wudu or not, but some things everyone agrees upon. Okay? So everyone knows, for example, that anything that comes out from your private parts of stool or urine or wind breaks your wudu. This is ijma', this is consensus, everyone agrees upon this. Okay? Now, most of the ulama, they also said that anything else that comes out from private parts also breaks your wudu. Okay? So, for example, the sisters, they asked about the liquid that comes out. Okay? Based on the fact that most scholars said that it breaks your wudu, this is why I also said it breaks your wudu. Okay? That anything that comes out, not necessarily urine and stool and wind, but other objects or other things too that comes out from your private parts. Okay? And this seems to be the correct opinion also, is that anything that comes out of your private parts, it breaks your wudu. Okay? So whether it's wind or gas or urine or stool or feces or anything that comes out from the two private parts, whether it's water, the moisture, anything that comes out, it breaks your wudu. Also, what breaks your wudu is if you go into a coma or if you go into unconsciousness. Okay, this also, if you wake up, then you have broken your wudu. Okay. Also, what breaks your wudu is if you. Well, now we're getting to the ikhtilaf now, so let me go a bit slower now. Okay, another thing that breaks your wudu for sure is eating camel meat. Eating camel meat. The Prophet ﷺ said, or a person asked the Prophet ﷺ, should we do wudu from eating goat meat? The Prophet ﷺ said no. Then he was asked, should we do wudu from eating camel meat? So the Prophet ﷺ said, yes, do wudu when you eat camel meat. And this is reported in Muslim. Okay? So this is a clear and explicit hadith which tells you that when you eat camel meat, then your wudu is broken. Now we're going to get to other factors which need a little bit of explanation. Okay. Now the biggest, or one of the most important differences of opinion over what breaks your wudu is sleeping. Sleeping. Does sleeping break your wudu? And I think there are like 8 or 9 opinions regarding this issue. Each one is a slightly different one. Okay. However, in my humble opinion, the criterion for sleeping to break your wudu is that when you go to sleep in a manner that you totally lose consciousness. So everyone knows when he's sitting in class, for example, I hope this doesn't happen in our class, but in many classes, you just nod off gently, you know. You're not really unconscious, right? I mean, if someone says something loud, you wake up and hear it. So you really have possession of some type of, you know, you're not really fully asleep. You're not in a deep sleep. This doesn't break your wudu, okay? But a deep sleep in which you totally lose consciousness, you know, you have no idea what's going on around you, which is like how we go to sleep at night or something. This breaks your wudu. Now the point is, there's a number of different hadith which seem to contradict each other. That's why the scholars have differed. One hadith says that al-ainu wika'u sahi, faman nama falyatawadda, that the eye now is like the drawstring. What is a drawstring? A drawstring is if you have a packet or a leather pouch, then they would have a string on top of that would make it tight. Okay? It just closes the thing. Okay? It's like the cap or the something. So the Prophet ﷺ gave an example or the parable. He said that the eye, it is acting like a drawstring for the anus, for the private parts. So it protects any gas from coming out. In other words, when you're awake, then you realize when you emit gas or not. Okay? So the Prophet said that the eye, it is as if it's acting like the wika, or the drawstring of the anus. So whoever goes to sleep, let him do wudu. This is an authentic hadith in Abu Dawud. Whoever goes to sleep, let him do wudu. Okay? So now you might think, okay, that means any sleep. But now we come to other ahadith which seem to say something else. And that is, for example, the Sahaba, they would be waiting for the Isha prayer, and the Prophet would come out late. So some of them would go to sleep in the masjid. Okay? And then when the Prophet came in, they would wake up and they would pray without doing wudu again. So now the Prophet saw them sleeping. But he didn't tell them to go make wudu. Okay? So in order to combine or reconcile these two hadith, that's how there are so many different opinions. Many scholars, they said that if you're sitting upright with your back to a wall and you fall asleep in this position, then it doesn't break your wudu. Why is that? Why do they specify this position? Because if you're sitting in this position, no gas can come out. Okay? If you sit with your back to a wall, right, and you're sitting firmly on the ground, no gas can come out. So they said that the Sahaba were sitting like this, therefore it was allowed. Okay? And this is a good opinion. I mean, you know, you can't really, it's a good opinion, but Allahu A'lam, I think the stronger opinion is you take it back to the type of sleep that you have. If it's just a slight sleep, like the Prophet, like imagine the Sahaba, they're waiting and they just went to sleep, right? They just went to sleep in this fashion, a slight sleep. In this case, you can say that the wudu does not break. Because if some gas came out, it would have woken you up. You would still be conscious of what's going on. Okay. However, a deep sleep, even if you go to sleep with your back to the wall, it is possible that gas and more than gas will come out and you're not aware of it. You know. So Allahu A'lam, in my humble opinion, this is the correct opinion. But like I said, there is a real strong ikhtilaf here. I'm telling you the ikhtilaf so that you know it. That, you know, it's up to you. There are two supposedly contradictory hadith. So what is the correct opinion out of these two? On the one hand, the Prophet clearly said that the eye is the drawstring of the anus, so whoever goes to sleep, let him do wudu. On the other hand, the Prophet saw the Sahaba sleeping. The Sahaba, they would be sleeping, waiting for Isha, and then they will wake up and pray. So how do you reconcile these two? The scholars, they have different ways of reconciling these two hadith, and the way that I presented is perhaps what I feel to be the stronger one. Okay, that's the first quote-unquote controversial thing. So far, how many factors have we listed that break wudu? How many? Mention. The first one is? Anything that comes out of your private parts. So now this actually includes many things. It includes urine and feces and stool. Well, same thing. Wind. Anything else, like the moisture that comes out or the water that comes out. Even stones. You know, kidney stones, for example. Okay. According to this opinion, if it is excreted in urine, or if it's excreted without urine, it will break the wudu. According to this opinion. Anything that comes out of the two private parts. Okay. What was the second thing? Unconsciousness. The third thing? Eating camel meat. The fourth thing right now is sleep, and we said a certain type of sleep, a very heavy or a deep sleep, but like I said, there's a difference of opinion. Another very controversial, or not controversial, but difference of opinion, strong difference of opinion, is touching the private parts, touching one's penis or anus, or the woman's touching themselves, okay? If you touch it when you're cleansing yourself for something, does that break your wudu or not? Okay. Well, obviously, if you're in the restroom, it breaks your wudu for other reasons because you just did something. But if you just touch yourself, suppose you're taking a shower, okay, and you just touch your private parts. Now, when we say touch, we mean by the palm of your hand, not by any other. Like, for example, if your leg touches your private parts, obviously it's not going to break your wudu. Okay, obviously it's not because your leg is always touching your private parts. But when we mean by the palm or the front part of the hand, not even the back, not even the arm, we mean the palm of the hand. Okay, if you touch your private parts, either the front or the back. And when we say the back private parts, and again, brothers and sisters, we shouldn't be embarrassed about mentioning these type of things. Neither should we find it amusing. This is part of our religion, you know. It's part of our religion. So we have to sometimes be explicit, not in order to make ourselves feel embarrassed, but so that we know our religion and we worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala properly. So if a person touches his front private part or his back private part, and by the back private parts we mean the actual anus, not the buttocks around it, because that is not a private part in the sense that it's najis. But the actual hole or the actual anus, this is what if we're talking about. If we touch it, does this break a wudu or not? Now, why is there a difference of opinion? Again, there are two supposedly contradictory hadith. And again, there's no real contradiction, but it's just how do we reconcile them. On the one hand, there's the hadith of Busra bin Safwan. The hadith of Busra bin Safwan, in which the Prophet ﷺ said, whoever touches his private parts, whoever touches, the hadith says penis, whoever touches his penis, let him do wudu. And obviously the woman fall into the same category. If they touch their private parts, let them do wudu. And another narration, it explicitly says, whatever man touches his penis, a woman touches her vagina, then they have to do wudu. Okay? It explicitly mentions both men and women. On the other hand, we have the hadith of Talq ibn Ali, another companion. And Talq ibn Ali said that, Ya Rasulullah, if one of us touches our private parts, does he have to do wudu? So the Prophet said, is not your private part just a part of you? Is not your penis, the hadith says, is not your penis just a part of you? In other words, just like if you touch your hand or your nose or your ears or anything, it doesn't break your wudu. Likewise, your penis is not going to, if you touch it, it's not going to break your wudu. Okay? Likewise, for the woman, if they touch their private parts, it's not going to break their wudu. The question arises, how do we reconcile these two hadith? And once again, there are like four or five opinions. The one that I personally lean towards, well, for sure, first of all, it's safer to do wudu if you touch your parents. For sure. You get out of the difference of opinion. I mean, no one says you shouldn't do wudu if you touch your parents. It's better to do anyway. But some say it doesn't break your wudu, some say it does. So in my humble opinion, the way to reconcile these two hadith is that if someone touches it consciously, in other words, intending to touch his private parts. For whatever reason he touches it, doesn't matter. If he touches his private parts consciously, then this breaks your wudu. And if you touch it unconsciously, you're not intending to touch it. So for example, you're taking a shower and you just start drying yourself. Unconsciously you touch your private parts. You don't intend to touch it. This doesn't break your wudu. This is the opinion that I follow, and it's the opinion of the Sunnah Malikiyah. And another strong opinion, which also makes sense, is that if you touch your private parts with desire, with pleasure, then this breaks your wudu. And if you touch it for other reasons, for washing or something, it doesn't break your wudu. But I personally lean to the opinion that if you touch it consciously, it breaks your wudu. And if you touch it unconsciously, it doesn't break your wudu. Some scholars, they said if you touch it, no matter whatever reason you touch it for, it'll still break your wudu. And this also is a good opinion. And it's a safer opinion. It's a safer opinion. Why? Because either way, you're safe. If it breaks your wudu, it doesn't break your wudu, you might as well do wudu again. Is that clear? The reason I'm going into this ikhtilaf is because there is a strong difference of opinion. In general, I don't go into ikhtilaf. But in these two, three issues, there is a strong difference of opinion. And I feel that you should be aware of it. And I don't want you to come and tell you my opinion. I want you to tell you there are other opinions out there. And, you know, ask other scholars, ask other people, and then follow what you feel is closest to the Quran and Sunnah. Now, obviously, if you touch your own private parts, it breaks your wudu. Obviously, if you touch another person, like your spouse's or your wife's private parts, it also breaks your wudu. Okay, so it doesn't matter, you know, if you touch your own or your wife's private part, it breaks your wudu, likewise. Now realize though, if you touch, for example, your wife's private parts, it breaks your wudu, not hers. Okay, it breaks your wudu because you did the touching. The one that does the touching, that wudu is broken. Okay, unless, of course, another factor that breaks wudu, obviously, we're getting there right now, is pre-seminal fluid. Okay, which is the fluid that is released when a person is in a state of sexual excitement. So unless, of course, a person is releasing pre-seminal fluid, in this case, obviously, his wudu is broken anyway. Doesn't matter if he touches his private part or his wife, it doesn't matter. Okay? Clear? Understood? So far, how many things do we have? Six? Okay. One aspect which the scholars say is recommended to make wudu for is after you wash a dead body. After you carry a dead body. Okay, even if you wash it, it's recommended to do wudu, but it's not necessary. Now, a question that arises, how about if you vomit? Does that break your wudu or not? How about if you vomit? Does that break your wudu or not? Many scholars, they said it does break your wudu. Many scholars said, no, it doesn't break your wudu. Okay. Once again, the reason there's a difference even over this issue is because there is no clear-cut hadith that says whoever vomits his wudu breaks. Whoever vomits his wudu breaks. There's no such hadith like that. Okay? So the scholars have differed. Does vomiting break your wudu or not? And the opinion that I lean towards is that it does not break your wudu, but it is strongly encouraged to do wudu afterwards. It does not break your wudu. Vomiting does not break your wudu. Why? Because had vomiting broken the wudu, the Prophet would have explicitly mentioned it. The very fact that the Prophet ﷺ did not mention vomiting shows you that it doesn't break your wudu. And vomiting is something that everyone does. Every single one of us vomits sometime in his lifetime. Despite that fact, the Prophet didn't instruct the Muslims that when you vomit, it breaks your wudu. But he did instruct them when you pass gas or wind or stool or urine or feces or this or that, it breaks your wudu. He told them this. But concerning vomit, he didn't say anything. So the reason or the opinion that I lean towards is that vomiting does not break your wudu. Because had it broken your wudu, the Prophet would have mentioned it. However, it is strongly, strongly encouraged to do wudu after someone vomits. This is because there is one hadith in which the Prophet Abu Darda says that the Prophet ﷺ vomited once and he did wudu. He vomited once and he did wudu after that. Okay, so this hadith, it doesn't tell you, or you cannot derive from this hadith that vomiting breaks the wudu, but you can derive that it is strongly encouraged to do wudu after someone vomits. So vomiting does not break the wudu, but if you do vomit, then it's best to do wudu. Likewise, the same ruling applies to bleeding. The same ruling applies to bleeding. If you bleed, now a small amount of blood, ijma'an, I mean by consensus, doesn't break the wudu. Like a nasal blood or something, small amount, a few drops, okay? It doesn't break the wudu by ijma', unless it comes out of the private parts, right? Otherwise, it doesn't break the wudu. Like if you have a little cut, small cut, doesn't break the wudu. The difference of opinion is, when you have a large amount of blood, you have a severe wound, and it's just flowing, does that break your wudu or not? Now, firstly, blood, like we said, is najis. According to the vast majority of scholars, flowing blood, a lot of blood, not a little amount. So, whether it breaks your wudu or not, you cannot pray with that blood on you. You have to wash it or you have to clean the clothes or something. Now, the question arises, does it break your wudu or not? There are two separate factors, okay? And I mentioned this last lesson too. Brothers and sisters should realize the difference between najis and between breaking wudu. Urine is najis, okay? If urine were to fall on you, it doesn't break your wudu. You have najis, you have to clean that najis, but you don't have to do wudu before praying. Okay, you understand that point. Likewise, bleeding, if you're bleeding excessively, that blood is najis. But does it break your wudu or not is a different question. Okay, is that clear? Yes, no? Okay, that hadith we're going to come to. Naam. Naam. So, the correct opinion is that the bleeding does not break the wudu. Because of the fact, the same reason that we gave for vomit. What reason did we give for vomit? He didn't specifically say. And it's something which everyone, I mean every single person, especially during those times in jihad and stuff, they're bleeding a lot, you know. The Prophet never mentioned it broke the wudu. Okay. And also the incident that the brother mentioned, that the Sahabi was praying once and an arrow came and struck him while he was in tahajjud and the blood was flowing out of him. Okay, so that could be used, you know, to show that it doesn't break your wudu. Another factor that does not break your wudu, and the reason I'm mentioning factors that don't break your wudu is because some people might tell you they do. So I'm telling you the opinion that they don't break your wudu is to touch a woman. Just to touch a woman. Not talking about a private part, just to touch a woman. Many of the scholars, they say if you touch a woman, it breaks your wudu. But this is not true. And this is very clearly not true because the Prophet ﷺ, Aisha herself narrated that the Prophet ﷺ would kiss some of his wives, kiss them, not just touch. And a kiss is something which is a sexual nature. Okay? He would kiss some of his wives and then go to pray without doing wudu again. So you're allowed to touch your wife and you're allowed to touch, if you touch your sister or your mother, it doesn't break your wudu. Touching a woman doesn't break your wudu. Some people, they say that, but this is not true. And this is clearly shown. If the Prophet ﷺ can even kiss Aisha and kiss his wife and then go and pray, right? This shows you that doing these type of acts does not break the wudu. Now, when would it break the wudu though? If it led to arousal and sexual, not necessarily arousal, there's a difference between arousal and pre-seminal fluid. A man can be aroused without emitting any fluid, okay? If he is aroused, right, this doesn't mean that his wudu is broken. Only if seminal fluid, or if that pre-seminal fluid is ejected, not really ejected, but released. Only at this point in time is his wudu broken. And we said that a small amount of pre-seminal fluid, just like a small amount of blood is forgiven. You can ignore it, okay? And everyone knows what a small amount is for himself. A very small amount, he can ignore it. If it's continuous or a large amount, this is when he has to be strict and his wudu is broken. Okay, so how many wudus do we have total? Things that break the wudu. Nine? What is the first one? Let's go over this quickly, because we have to know these things. And this is a juicy question for the exam, by the way, too. Anything coming from the private parts, first thing. Second thing. Coma. Third thing. Chamomile. Fourth thing. Sleeping. Fifth. Touching private parts, when though? When did... This is the opinion that, like I said, I go to, okay? Consciously, okay. Sixth thing. Huh? Seminal, touching the spouse's private parts falls under that. Okay? Pre-seminal fluid, okay. No, we didn't say it breaks your wudu. What did we say? It's encouraged. Careful, don't... If you carry a dead body, you don't break your wudu. No. Careful, don't fall in. It's encouraged to do wudu. Just because the Prophet said, whoever washes a dead body, then he should take a shower. And whoever carries a dead body, then he should perform wudu. This should is not for wajib, it's for sunnah. In this hadith. So we're going to get to washing the dead body in a few, maybe next week. But if you wash the dead body, if you are the actual one that is washing it, it is encouraged to do a whole ghusl yourself. And if you only carry that dead body, it's encouraged. It doesn't break your wudu, it's encouraged to do wudu again. Okay, what's another factor? What do we say about vomiting? It's recommended. Again, careful. Don't get confused between what breaks your wudu and what is recommended to do wudu for, okay? What is another factor? Sleeping. What do we say about sleeping? A deep sleep. Yeah. How about bleeding? What do we say about bleeding? No, it doesn't. Okay, it's recommended, yeah, but it doesn't break your wudu. Yeah. Huh? I mean, every time a najas or something comes out, it's recommended to wudu, but it doesn't break your wudu. Bleeding, gushing blood does not break your wudu, but that blood itself is najas. Okay? Gushing blood, and like I said, there is ikhtilaf. The reason I'm mentioning all of these points is because some scholars said that they do break your wudu. Okay? And, you know, I'm teaching you this, and, you know, like I said, I mean, fiqh is something, alhamdulillah, go and study it, and if you think one opinion is stronger than another, follow it. I mean, don't, you know, fiqh is something, alhamdulillah, you can be a bit more lax about, you know. Tayyib, is that clear now? All of these points are clear? Okay. Now, the next chapter that we get to is, what are the acts that are prohibited for a person who is not in the state of wudu? What are the long chapter title? Basically, what do you need to have wudu for? The opposite of the chapter title I just said. What are the acts that you need to have wudu for? Obviously, the first and the foremost thing is prayer. And this is why we're studying this chapter right now before prayer. The first prerequisite, the first act for which you need to have wudu is prayer. The Prophet ﷺ said, whoever ahdath, whoever breaks his wudu, then Allah will not accept his prayer until he does wudu. Okay? Whoever breaks his wudu, Allah will not accept his prayer until he makes wudu. So if you break your wudu by any one of these factors that we just mentioned, you have to do wudu before prayer timing. This is very clear. Every single one of us knows this. Okay? Another factor that requires wudu is to touch the Qur'an. Okay? If you want to touch the Qur'an, not recite, touch it with your hand physically like this. Suppose this is the Qur'an, I wanted to touch the Qur'an. Pick it up and read from the Qur'an. This, according to the vast majority of the scholars of this ummah, and the opinion of all of the Sahaba and the Salaf, is that you have to have wudu to touch the Mus'haf. Okay? We'll get to the question later, we have to finish up. You have to have wudu to touch the Mus'haf. This is because the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said in a hadith narrated by Ad-Dawqutni and Bayhaqi and others, that no one to touch the Qur'an unless he is tahir. No one should touch the Qur'an unless he is tahir, meaning he is in a state of wudu. Tahir means pure. So no one except the one who is pure, he has wudu, he should touch the Qur'an. Okay? So, yeah, this hadith is not related to touching the Qur'an, though. The Muslim doesn't become najis. Yeah, the Muslim himself never becomes najis. But in this hadith, when the Prophet says tahir, right, the Muslim, is he in a state of janaba ever? Of course he's in a state of, we're going to get to the state of janaba next, right? But is he in a state of janaba? Of course he's in a state of janaba. But he's not in a state of najis. So the people that use that hadith, they are mixing up between two things. Okay, the person is in a state of janaba, yes. And in the state of janaba, he is not najis. In other words, everyone knows what janaba is, or we're going to get there in the next chapter. Okay. Sexual defilement, right? Janaba. If a person is in a state of janaba, he himself is not najis. You can touch him and you don't have to do wudu if you touch him. Okay? But that doesn't mean that he can touch the Quran or do things like that. So it's confusing between two things. The opinion of the majority of scholars, the former dhahibs and all of the ulama of the salaf, is that you have to have wudu to touch the Quran. Not to recite the Quran. To touch the Quran. To touch the mushaf. Now this means that the books of tafsir, for example, you can touch them. Because that's not the Quran. We're talking about the Qur'an, the pure mushaf, in which the Arabic text is the most. We're not talking about the tafsir and the hadith, no. Just for the mushaf, the Qur'an, like these mushafs over here. Okay? Books of tafsir, in which there's a lot of tafsir for every verse, and most of the book is tafsir, you're allowed to touch that. That's not the Qur'an, that's not the mushaf. Okay? Another factor for which you need wudu is to do tawaf around the Kaaba. Okay? So these are the three main things for which you need wudu for. To do tawaf around the Kaaba. This is because the Prophet ﷺ said that tawaf around the Kaaba is like salah. Tawaf around the Kaaba is like salah. In other words, the Prophet ﷺ compared tawaf with salah, except he said that tawaf you can speak and salah you cannot. So this implies then that one of the conditions for tawaf is wudu. Likewise, the Prophet when he entered Mecca to do tawaf, I think Aisha, I forgot who reported, she said that the Prophet did wudu before he started the tawaf. Okay. We can save the question because we have to finish up. You know? But the majority of scholars said that the tawaf is prerequisite of tawaf is to have wudu. Okay. Now, what do you need in order to? Well, first let's get into now ghusl then. Okay, so these are the three main things that you need for wudu. What is the first one? Prayer. This is, everyone knows this, by ijma', no difference of opinion. Okay, second one? Touching the mus'haf. And third one? Tawaf around the Kaaba. Okay, these three things, you need to have wudu to touch, to do these three things. Okay, now we get to another chapter. Well, before we move on to the chapter, one principle that you should know. Write this principle down. Whoever is sure of his purity and unsure of his impurity, whoever is sure that he's in a state of purity, meaning he has wudu, and he's unsure whether he broke his wudu or not, then he relies upon what he is sure of. Now how do we put that into practice? Suppose you did wudu, and you're positive you did wudu at 10 o'clock. Okay? Now it's 12 o'clock. And Shaitan comes to you and says, oh, I think you broke your wudu, I think you passed wind here, or you went to... You're not sure though. Okay? But you're sure you did wudu. In this case, you ignore the whisperings of Shaitan. You take them out and you throw them away. And you base your acts upon what you are sure of, i.e. that you have wudu. Okay? Likewise, the opposite applies. When you are sure, that, for example, you went to the bathroom at 10 o'clock. Okay? And you're unsure, did I do wudu after that or not? Then you go back to what you are sure about. So in other words, you don't let Shaitan come and, you know, whisper to you and give, no. What you are sure of, you act upon that. And what you are unsure of, you reject. So this is a principle that Shaitan really messes people up with this, you know. And he causes you to doubt. During prayer, he comes and you're standing in prayer and you're like, hey, I did go to the wudu, but I'm not sure. I think I might have broken it. And during the whole prayer, you're worried, do you have wudu or not? No. You ignore it. You ignore it. As long as you are sure that you did wudu and you're unsure that you broke it. Now, suppose you're sure you broke it, obviously. If you're sure you broke your wudu, obviously you go by based upon what you are sure of. For example, you did wudu at 10 o'clock, and then you went again to the bathroom where you broke your wudu at 11. You're sure you did it, khalas, you go and do wudu again. We're talking about if you're unsure, if you just think, you have doubts, you base what you are sure about, and you reject what you are uncertain about. Okay, now we talk about, before we get to ghusl, let us do the factors that necessitate ghusl. Before we jump into the how to do ghusl, we get to the next chapter, which is the factors that necessitate ghusl. In other words, when do we need to do ghusl? When is it wajib? When is it obligatory to do ghusl? Okay. The first reason or the first condition or the case in which we have to do ghusl is when a man ejects seminal fluid. Okay, when a man ejects seminal fluid, when he has an orgasm basically, he has to do wudu. He becomes in a state of janabah, and he has to do wudu in this state. Okay, likewise, if a woman, ghusl, he has to do ghusl, excuse me. If a woman, if a man has a wet dream, okay, and he wakes up and he finds the traces of his sperm on his body or on his clothes, then he has to do wudu. Okay. Likewise, if a woman also, she has a wet dream, and she finds traces of the water, when she wakes up, then she too must do wudu. Okay? Ghusl, excuse me. Getting late, as usual. So, releasing seminal fluid, which is the actual sexual fluid, not pre-sexual fluid, the actual fluid from which the baby is formed. Okay? So, if the woman has a... Well, for the woman, it doesn't apply. For the man, when he releases his sperm in a state of wakingness or sleep, okay, then he must do ghusl. When the woman, she releases or she has an orgasm and she is asleep and she wakes up and she finds the fluid, she finds the liquid, then she must do wudu. Because the Prophet said to the woman that came and asked about, we mentioned this hadith yesterday, the woman that came and asked about if I have a wet dream, do I have to do wudu? Ghusl, excuse me. And Aisha said, what, do women have wet dreams? Because it's very uncommon amongst women, okay? Or in another narration she said, you have embarrassed women by saying this. Aisha told the Ansari woman, you have embarrassed women by saying this, because it's not very common. So Aisha, the Prophet rebuked Aisha, and he told her that, you know, it does happen, and that she should not be embarrassed to ask this question. And in fact, he praised the woman for not being shy about asking her religion, because this is important. Suppose it did necessitate ghusl, and she didn't do ghusl, then her prayer is not going to be accepted. So it's very important. So the Prophet said, yes, If the woman sees what a man sees in his dream, and she sees the water when she wakes up, right, then she must do ghusl. Now the question arises, especially amongst men, is that suppose they have a dream, and yet they're not sure did they actually have an orgasm or not, okay? Suppose you just dreamt, had a wet dream. Well, you're not really have a wet dream, but you have a dream. And you woke up and you didn't find any traces, okay, of any liquid. In this case, you don't have to do ghusl. Why? Because until you are sure that you actually had an orgasm, that actually the liquid came out. Likewise for the woman, until it is sure that the liquid actually was emitted, until this point you don't have to do wudu. If you just saw a dream of a sexual nature, you don't have to do wudu. Okay? You have to emit or you have to have the orgasm, the seminal fluid has to come out. That is when ghusl is obligatory. So the first thing that obligates ghusl is what? When the man releases his seminal fluid, okay, his sperm. Likewise, and you can put under, not necessarily point two, but under this is that when a woman has a wet dream also, and she see, and likewise a woman, when a man has a wet dream. The second thing that makes ghusl obligatory is when a man enters a woman, when the penis of the man enters the vagina of the woman, even if it doesn't go all the way in. This is very important. Even if it doesn't go all the way in, if it just enters, that's all it has to do. Okay? And this is very important that we have to be a bit explicit here. Okay? But again, the brother should realize this is something that every single one of us, the married couples, will have to face. Even if you're not married now, you will have to know these rulings for when you get married. Okay? Is that if a man is playing with his wife, but he doesn't enter her, even if his private part touches her private part, okay? But he doesn't enter her, it does not cause ghusl. Obviously, if there's sexual excitement and the pre-seminal fluid is coming out, then the wudu is obligated, right? The wudu is obligated, but not ghusl. Only when the tip of his private part enters her, even if it's a little bit, but he has to enter her body, only then at that point, ghusl becomes obligatory. Whether either of them have an orgasm or none of them have an orgasm or both of them, it doesn't matter. As long as the tip of his private part entered into her, then the ghusl becomes obligatory at this point in time. It doesn't matter what happens after that. Okay, so he can exit her right then and there, or he can continue, or he can have an orgasm, or she can have it, or both. It doesn't matter. The point is, when the Prophet ﷺ said that when the two circumcised organs touch, when the two circumcised organs, meaning the penis and the vagina, when they touch, well, the hadith says when they touch, but the scholars have said what it means by touches and when it enters into her, then ghusl becomes obligatory. This is what the Prophet said. Okay? That when the two circumcised organs, they come into contact with each other, then ghusl becomes obligatory. But we said that what is meant by contact, it doesn't mean that the private part is just touching, the two private parts are touching each other. It means that it must actually enter her. Okay? Even if it's only a small amount, the point is he must enter her for ghusl to become mandatory. Another point that makes ghusl obligatory is when a person accepts Islam. When a person accepts Islam, this is now, how many points have we done for ghusl? Three. What was the first one? Rejecting. Second one was? Okay, the third one now is when a person accepts Islam. Okay, this is because based on the hadith of the Prophet ﷺ, when a person accepted Islam, he said, cut your jahiliyyah hair, right? And in some narrations he said, take a shower. Okay, take a bath. Okay, اغتسل, take a shower. And there are other narrations that the Prophet ﷺ commanded Qais ibn Asim to take a shower when he accepted Islam. He commanded him to take a bath when he accepted Islam. So when someone comes to you and he wants to accept Islam, right? Don't tell him don't accept Islam until you take a shower, but say, okay, it is encouraged, or it is... you know, you should take a shower so that spiritually it's as if you are washing away your kufr from before. So you tell him, alhamdulillah, very good. Why don't you come to the masjid, take a shower and come to the masjid. Or even just say shahada now. But the point is, tell him to take a ghusl as soon as he can. Okay? Tell him to take a bath as soon as he can. So it becomes obligatory to take a bath when a person wishes to accept Islam. Likewise, another point or another factor which causes obligation of ghusl is when the menstrual blood stops. When a woman stops her menstrual blood, she has to do ghusl. Likewise, when a woman stops her postnatal bleeding, her nifas. Postnatal bleeding is the bleeding that occurs after childbirth. When that blood stops, she is obligated, she is obliged to take a shower. And this is something, unfortunately, many, many, many sisters are very lazy about. They think that because they don't have to pray, and we're going to get to these rulings in a while, they think that when their blood stops, and it's supposed an hour before Dhuhr, let's say, well, let me just, you know, not take the shower until after Asr, so that I don't have to pray Dhuhr. No, she is obliged to pray as soon as her blood stops. We're going to discuss this in more detail, but the point is, suppose there's 10 minutes left for Dhuhr prayer. Suppose Asr prayer is at 5 o'clock, and her blood finishes at 4:50. Okay? She'll say, okay, I won't take a shower until 5:10, so I don't have to pray Dhuhr. No. As soon as the blood stops, and she knows that she's obliged to take a shower, she must take a shower and pray Dhuhr immediately. Even if the time exits, suppose there's 10 minutes left, and her shower took her 20 minutes. That's fine. She's not sinful for delaying the prayer, because she was forced to take a shower. But she is sinful if she doesn't pray. Do you understand the difference? Okay, even if the timing has exited, she must still take a shower and pray as long as her blood stopped before. And this is something, unfortunately, many, many sisters are very lazy about. And they think that, astaghfirullah, they're trying to pray a trick with Allah, that if they just delay their shower. And this is true, many sisters, they do this. They think that if they delay their shower, they don't have to pray. No, it is obligated for her, as soon as her blood finishes, to take a shower as soon as possible, and to offer her prayer that her blood stopped in. And we're going to get to the rulings of the menstruating woman, inshallah, in a little while, maybe 10, 20 minutes, inshallah. Okay, likewise, there's one last factor that obligates ghusl, but this is beyond a person's control, and that is when he dies. When a person dies, someone else has to wash him. Okay, when a person dies, someone else has to wash him. So how many factors do we have then that necessitate ghusl? Five or six? Six? Mention them one by one, so we know this for sure. First one is? Okay. Yaqi, what's the second one? Second one. Wait, we're going. When a man enters a woman, okay. Third one, Imran. Guys, I'm asking one at a time, sir. Except it's not. Fourth one. Look at your own notes. Oh, you missed this fourth one. Okay, when a woman stops her menstrual bleeding, the fifth one. No, if you're getting postnatal bleeding. No, it's not the same blood, it's different blood. That's a different category. Nifas, yes, postnatal bleeding. We're going to get to the rulings of women's blood in a short while. Okay, sixth one, death. So there are six things that we mentioned that necessitate ghusl. Okay, when a person... Now, when a person is in a state of janaba, what is janaba? Sexual impurity. So sexual impurity is caused by what then? One of two things. The first two that we mentioned. Either he releases, either he has an orgasm, or he enters his wife. Okay? So one of these two things causes janaba. When a person is in a state of janaba, what is he not allowed to do? This is another chapter now. Well, obviously, whatever was there, we don't have to mention here. Obviously, whatever was mentioned that you're not allowed to have, you're not allowed to do without wudu. Obviously, you're not allowed to do without ghusl either. Okay, without while you're in a state of janaba. We're now talking about what are the factors that he can do without wudu, but he cannot do in a state of janaba. Okay, according to the majority of people, he cannot recite the Quran. Recite the Quran. Okay, this is different from when he was not in a state of wudu. He cannot touch the Quran, but he can recite the Quran. Now that he's in a state of janaba, right? Now he cannot even recite the Qur'an according to the majority of scholars, and there is a strong difference of opinion about this issue. But it is really better not to recite the Qur'an when you're in a state of janaba. Okay? Okay. Another factor that he cannot do is what? Can anyone guess? Well, I quickly look up some more. What is another thing that he cannot do? No, obviously, what is mentioned over there is obviously he cannot do it here. You don't have to, you know, you understand. Obviously, what you cannot do without wudu, you obviously cannot do while you're in a state of janaba. We're not talking about what are the factors that he cannot do even, well, we already mentioned something. What else can he not do? Stay in the masjid. Exactly, exactly. Very good. This is in the, referred to in the Quran. Is that in Surah Nisa, verse 43, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَلَا جُنُوبًا إِلَّا عَابِرِ سَبِيلًا. Don't go into the masjid in a state of janaba, except if you're passing through. So suppose now in those days the masjid, you know, they used to have like doors here and doors there, so it's like pass through. So unless you have to pass through or just, you know, do something quickly, you can't sit down in the masjid, you can't just relax in the masjid. No. If you're in a state of janaba, you cannot enter the masjid. Likewise, women, in their menstrual cycles cannot enter the masjid according to the correct opinion. They are not allowed to enter the masjid according to the correct opinion. This is because the Prophet said in an explicit hadith, لَا أُحِلُّ الْمَسْجِدَ لِحَائِضٍ وَلَا جُنُبٍ. I don't allow the masjid for the ha'id, for the woman in menstruation, and the junub, the man in the state of janaba, or the woman in the state of janaba. This is reported by Abu Dawood, and some of the scholars of hadith have made it da'if. Even though they have made it da'if, there are other evidences also that show that the woman should not enter the masjid in a state of menstruation. The prayer hall does not qualify as a masjid unless five prayers are offered there and Jum'ah is offered there. Masjid means that you have the five prayers there. Many places in Houston there are musallas, which means sometimes you pray, sometimes you don't. Two prayers are offered, three prayers are offered. This is not the masjid. The masjid is that place in which all five prayers are offered. That is the masjid. According to the correct opinion, women cannot enter those type of places. Okay. So these are the two main things that are prohibited for the person in the state of janaba. Okay. What are the two things? Recite Quran and enter the masjid. Okay. Now concerning menstruating women touching the Quran, obviously they cannot touch the Quran because they're not in wudu. How about reciting the Quran? Now in general, they should not recite the Quran for the sake of worship. In other words, they're in their third menstruation, they say, okay, I want to do a good deed, let me recite the Quran. No, they shouldn't. They should just make some dhikr. La ilaha illallah, subhanallah, alhamdulillah. However, if the woman have a habit, the woman has a habit of reciting the Quran every day, suppose she recites one page or two pages every day, in this case, the scholars say it's allowed for her, if she wears gloves or she has some type of cloth, to continue her habit of before. In other words, she shouldn't make it a point during her menstruation to recite something new. Unless it's her habit from before. For example, every day she reviews one surah of her. Suppose she's memorized Juz Amma. Okay? Every day she reviews one surah or one page. In her menstruation, she shouldn't stop her habit. Continue her habit. But don't make a new habit. That, okay, I want to do some worship, so let me recite, you know, Surah Tabarak or Surah some jinn today. No. Okay, is that clear? Is that if she has an old habit, or she wants to memorize the Quran, or she's a Quran, not memorize, excuse me, she wants to review the Quran, or she's a Quran teacher and it's her job to, you know, touch the Quran or something, or to review the Quran, in this case, she should wear gloves, or she should have a cloth, or she should have a pencil, something, that she doesn't physically touch the mushaf, and she can recite or do this. However, she should not make it a point to recite. In the state of janaba, however, nothing. In the state of janaba, why is the state of janaba different from the state of menstruation? Who can give me a good reason? Yusuf, what's a good reason? Why is the state of janaba different from the state of menstruation? Why are we making differentiation? Think. Menstruation is a long period of time. 6 days, 7 days. Janaba is in your hands. You can do it 1 minute and take a shower and you're out. Okay? Janaba is in your hands. So therefore the scholars have been more strict when it comes to janaba. Both men and women, when they are in a state of janaba, they should not touch the Quran, they should not do this, this, that. However, menstruation, the scholars have been a bit more lax, right? Because of the fact that it's not in their hands, it's beyond their control. Okay, so it's long days, 6-7 days, and it's possible that they might forget the Quran that they have memorized, or they need to review some Quran. So therefore, the scholars have been lax, and they said, as long as she wears gloves, as long as she has something that prevents her from actually touching the Quran, she can recite it if she has a habit of old. She shouldn't make a new habit of it. Clear enough? Everything clear there? Tayyib. Let's move on now to how to perform ghusl. Okay? How to perform ghusl. We talked about what necessitates ghusl, the 6 or 7 factors that necessitate ghusl. Now we talk about how to perform ghusl. Okay. Know that there are two ways of performing ghusl. There is the bare minimum that is necessary, and then there is the complete way. Okay, so there are two ways of performing ghusl. There is the bare minimum, in other words, well, just get the job done, okay? And then there is the perfect or the recommended way of doing wudu. Now, the bare minimum way of doing wudu, ghusl. The bare minimum way of doing ghusl is that you make sure that all of your body is wet. That's all you have to do. Okay, obviously, before you write that down, make sure you obviously understand, just like in the wudu, you have to have the niyyah. Just like in wudu, you have to have the niyyah for ghusl. So suppose you're walking in the rain, and then you realize that you were in a state of janaba, and you needed to ghusl, unless you had the niyyah, that I'm doing ghusl now, walking in the rain, that's fine, as long as it wets your whole body, right? I'm doing ghusl now, if you have that niyyah, that's fine. If you don't have that niyyah, it doesn't matter. So you have to have the niyyah for ghusl, that I'm going to take the ghusl now. This is obviously understood. This is because the Prophet said, all actions are by intentions. All actions are by intentions. Okay? So if you don't have the intention for ghusl, your ghusl is not going to take place. But the point that I'm trying to stress is that the bare minimum for ghusl is that you have to wet every single external part of your body, including the madmada istinshaq. What is madmada? What is madmada? Mouth. Istinshaq. What is istinshaq? Into the nose and out of the nose. So you have to wet every single portion of the body. Okay? Now careful, many people, they take a shower, it doesn't necessarily qualify as ghusl. Why? Firstly, you have to have the niyyah. If it's a hot day and you just jump in the shower to cool down, and you don't have the niyyah for ghusl, this is not ghusl. Secondly, okay, many times when you take a shower, you don't wet every section of your body. Okay? And I have to be explicit, but, you know, forgive me, because like we said, for example, between the buttocks, okay? You have to wet this section of the body. If you don't, then this is not ghusl. Likewise, behind the knees. Okay? Likewise, underarm, all the way. I mean, every single external portion of the body has to be made wet. This is the bare minimum. And the Prophet would do ghusl with a very small amount of water, perhaps a med, which is like a bit less than this cup. Ghusl. Total ghusl from this amount of water. Okay? How do you do that? You just basically rub water all over your body. Okay? But the point is, you have to make sure that every single millimeter of your external body has been touched with water. You don't have to rub. Okay? Yakhi, instead of walking all the way, you can just pass it forward, and then the end, they can give it. You know, we still have 20 minutes before we ask questions. You know, tiring yourself out, you know. You don't have to rub your whole body. Just at the end, give it. You don't have to rub your whole body. Just like with wudu. What do we say about rubbing for wudu? What do we say? As long as it's wet, it's fine. Okay? Likewise, the same thing applies for ghusl. As long as it's wet, it's fine. But suppose you have very little water, of course, then you have to do ghusl. I mean, you have to do rubbing, because if you have a little water, there's no way you're going to be able to make sure that every single portion of your body becomes wet. Let's try to close the questions until... The hair also, okay. The hair also, we're getting there. Calm down. The hair. Now we... With regards to the hair, we have to make sure that the roots of the hair are wet. Not like wudu. Wudu, we don't have to make sure. With regards to the hair, we have to make sure that the roots become wet. So if we have a little amount of water, we have to basically rub it in. Rub it in the hair. We don't have to pour water on our head, but as long as the water reaches the roots of the hair, and it reaches the scalp, it's allowed. And it's okay. If it doesn't reach the scalp, you have to make sure it reaches the scalp. Okay? Now we get to the perfect way of making wudu. This was the bare minimum. Is that so? Basically, theoretically now, you're in front of a swimming pool, you need to do ghusl, you jump in for a dive, and you come out. You've done your ghusl. Okay? As long as you've done madmada istinshaq on the way into the dive, you know? I don't know how you're going to do that, but supposing you did that. Or as soon as you came out and you did madmada istinshaq. Okay? Suppose you dove into the swimming pool and you came out immediately. Your whole body is wet. You just do madmada istinshaq and you have done your minimum ghusl. This is the minimum ghusl. Likewise, you jump in the shower, you jump out. Less than 10 seconds. A minimum ghusl will take you less than 10, 20 seconds. Jump in the shower, wet your whole body, make sure everything is wet, and jump out. You've done your ghusl. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has made this religion very easy for us. Now the complete ghusl, or the sunnah way of making ghusl, is as follows. The Prophet ﷺ, when he would make ghusl, this is like in the hadith of Aisha and other hadith, the Prophet ﷺ, when he would make ghusl, the first thing he would do, obviously, in those days they would make ghusl sitting down, right? The first thing he would do would be to wash his private parts with his wet hands. Left or right? Left. Why? Because it is haram to touch the private parts with your right hand. We said this yesterday. It is haram under any circumstance, unless of course an emergency, medical food or something, haram under normal circumstances to touch either of your private parts with your right hand. You must do so with your left hand. Okay? He would first wash his private parts with his left hand. Wash it with water with his left hand. And then he would wash his left hand. That he would bang it or hit it with the sand of the ground and then wash that off. In other words, it's like soap and water of our times. Is that he would cleanse his hand of... Because obviously when a person is in a state of sexual defilement, then his private parts are dirty. Okay, there are najis, there is najis on them. So you have to wash the najis off, and then there's najis left on your hand. So then you wash the najis off your hand off. So the Prophet would, after he would wash his private parts, he would then rub it with the sand or something, and then wash his left hand. So now both of his hands are clean again. Then he would do a complete wudu. Not ghusl, wudu. He would do a complete wudu. So start off with the hands, madmada, istinshaq, face, okay, arms all the way to the elbows, washing the hair. But he would leave the feet. He wouldn't do the feet. You would leave the feet for the end. So wash the hair and then that's it. Okay, you wash there. After that, he would then take water and pour it on his right hand side 3 times. Like this. Now remember, there is no shower at that time. So you pour it on your right hand side and you rub all over your body. You rub all the way to the bottom. You rub so that there is nothing left. Then he would do it with his left hand side. Why? Because you should start cleaning with the right and then go to the left. So he would start with his right hand side, rub his body all the way down, all the way to the legs. Likewise with the left hand side. It's sooner to do 3 times that, but you can do it once. The point is, the bare minimum is once, okay? As long as you make it wet, okay? He's making his whole body wet, yeah. So you make the whole body wet. You put it on your right hand side and then on the left hand side. Again, you have to be careful that every single part of your body is wet. So between the buttocks, between the area, the thighs, all of this has to be wet. Okay, there's something that many people are lazy about, and this is not a complete ghusl done. You don't have a complete ghusl done. You have to make sure every part of your external body is wet. Okay, after doing that, after he would make sure that all of his body was wet, then he would move to another place, move 2 or 3 feet left or right. Why? Because that water was now dirty, and his feet were dirty, so he'd move to another place and then wash his feet. Wash his feet, just like you wash your feet for wudu. Okay, so this is the perfect manner of ghusl. The perfect manner of ghusl. Okay, you understand this now? You start off, you wash your private parts. Why? Because that's what was just made dirty with your sexual, acts. Then you do a then you wash your left hand because you have just cleansed your private part. Then you do a complete wudu. After that, you wash the remaining limbs. For example, your chest, your upper arm, okay, your feet, your thighs, your navel, below your navel. You can do a complete washing with water of your whole body, and then the Prophet would move. So that he could get away from that dirty spot or that dirty water and do or wash his feet at the end. After that, you have finished your ghusl. Okay? Now, obviously, in our modern day showers, all you have to do is take a shower. You can't really move anywhere. Just take a complete shower and try to follow the sunnah just to get the barakah. And it says, even under the shower, just do wudu. Just to get the barakah. Just to follow the sunnah of the Prophet ﷺ. And inshallah, Allah rewards you for that. Likewise, you can't hit your hand on the sand or dust. But just to follow the sunnah, once you wash your private parts, wash it with soap. And you know, just to follow the sunnah. Wash it with soap and do it the way the Prophet ﷺ did it. And if you do it, inshallah, Allah will reward you. Just because you are wanting to follow the sunnah of the Prophet ﷺ. Even though in our times, we don't have the way of doing ghusl that the Prophet ﷺ did. We don't do it standing, sitting up, we do it standing up, you know. And so many other factors. But just the point is to show that your love for the Prophet ﷺ, you should do it in that manner. Okay? It is obviously not liked to waste water during wudu. It is not like to waste water doing wudu or ghusl, both things. We mentioned wudu and we mentioned ghusl also. Unfortunately, at our times, we really do waste a lot of water. The Prophet would do wudu with this much amount of water, or less than this. In fact, it was like 2 mud, which is even less than this, really. A cup full of water. And in our times, we use at least 4 or 5 buckets of water when we do wudu. At least, if not more, you know. So, Allahumma sta'an, we should try our best to, you know, make it short and move on. Okay, a very important point for the sisters. They always ask, do we have to undo our hair if it's tied up in braids? Okay? For sure it is better if they do. For sure it is better. But the correct opinion is that both for menstruation and for janaba, they are not obligated to undo their hair if it's long and if it's in a braid. Okay? Obviously if it's very short hair, then there is no braid and they have to wash it completely. Okay? But if they have long hair and they have them in braids and they have, you know, all twisted and turned up, they don't have to undo all of that. Okay, they don't have to take it all out and wash their whole hair. It's enough if they wash the roots, their scalp, and then they take water on the outside of their hair. This is based on the hadith of the Prophet ﷺ in which he said that Umm Salama, or the Prophet's wife, said, Ya Rasulullah, I am a woman that has very tight and thick hair, long hair. Do I have to take it out every time I do a ghusl for janabah? So the Prophet said, no. It is enough for you that you throw on your head 3 handfuls of water. 3 handfuls of water, and then make sure that the water goes all over your body. Okay? So if you have your hair tied up in a braid or something, the sisters, they only have to make sure that the water is on their head, on their scalp, it gets to their scalp, and then on the external part of their remaining hair, they just pour water. Likewise, same thing for the menstruation. A woman came to the Prophet and said that, do I have to take it off when I take a ghusl for menstruation? The Prophet said no. And this is reported in Sahih Muslim. So both for janaba and for menstruation, she doesn't have to. However, she is encouraged to, strongly encouraged to, especially for menstruation, because a long time has gone since she's taken a shower, she is strongly encouraged to undo her hair. But it is not a wajib or a obligation for her to do so. Okay, after this, we will briefly mention, quickly mention, when it is encouraged to do ghusl, not mandatory. We talked about when it is mandatory to do ghusl. Now we'll briefly go over quickly when it is encouraged to do ghusl. Firstly, Jum'ah. Okay, Jum'ah. For the men that are going to attend the prayer, and the women also that are going to attend the prayer, the Prophet said, whoever attends Jum'ah, ghusl yawm al-jum'ah wajibun ala kulli muhtalim, that the ghusl of the day of Jum'ah, or the Friday, it is obligatory upon every person of age. When he says obligatory, other hadith show that it's sunnah. Okay, we don't have time to get into all of that, but basically it's strongly encouraged to take a shower every Friday. Also, it is strongly encouraged to take a shower after you have washed the dead body. We already mentioned the proof for this. The Prophet said, point number two, the Prophet said, whoever washes a dead body, he should take a shower. But it is not mandatory, it is just strongly encouraged. Also, on the day of Eid, he should take a shower. Okay? Likewise, it is recommended that if a person becomes unconscious, when he wakes up, he should also take a shower. Okay? Likewise, it is recommended when a person enters into the state of ihram. What is the state of ihram? When you go for hajj with the two white sheets, or even for women, it is recommended, strongly recommended, that they take a shower, because this was the sunnah of the Prophet ﷺ. Likewise, before they enter Makkah, right before they enter Makkah. So you put your ihram outside of Makkah. Then you, when in those days they used to walk, in our times it's maybe 10-minute drive, or sometimes 3 hours drive, depending on where you put your ihram on. You just, before you enter Makkah, it's also sunnah to take a shower there. Likewise, the 10th day of Dhul Hijjah in Hajj, in other words, the day of Arafah. In other words, if you're in Arafah, it's sunnah to take a shower on that day. Okay? Likewise, when the woman is in a state of istihaba, which we will talk about in 5-10 minutes, inshallah, when a woman is in the state of istihaba, in other words, she is continuously bleeding, and this is not the blood of menstruation or of postnatal bleeding, then she is strongly encouraged to take a shower every time she prays. It is not obligatory, but she is strongly encouraged to take a full shower every time she prays, when she is in a state of istihaba. And we're going to talk about this state in a little while. Okay? So with that, we've finished what are the recommended timings to do ghusl. Now we move on to tayammum, quickly. Tayammum. Very short chapter, very easy. Firstly, when is tayammum resorted to? Everyone knows what tayammum is. This is washing yourself or doing wudu without water, basically. A waterless wudu. In other words, it's a substitution for wudu and for ghusl. Tayammum, understand this, it's a substitution for wudu and for ghusl. Both things. Okay, when is tayammum resorted to? It is resorted to when there is a scarcity of water, or when there is no water. Okay, so suppose you're traveling, and you don't have enough water to take a shower with. You only have enough for your drinking need. In this case, you don't have to do ghusl or wudu. You can do tayammum when the time for prayer comes. Likewise, suppose you don't have any water and you're in the middle of the desert. Okay, time for prayer comes. Okay. Likewise, you would do the same thing. Suppose, though, you know that if you were to walk 10 miles or 20 miles, you would find water. What should you do then? What? Well, it depends. If this time that it takes you to get there would cause the time for the prayer to leave, then you do tayammum and you pray. Okay? However, if the time it takes you to get there is within the time for prayer, then in that case, you delay praying until you get to that area. Okay, so suppose you're driving along and the time for dhuhr comes. You don't have any water in the car. But you know that after half an hour, you're going to come to a stop or whatever, and there's going to be a place for you to do wudu. In this case, it's not allowed for you to get out of the car and do tayammum and pray. It's not allowed for you. Because you know, or you think, you presume that you're going to get water at that stop. Okay, so only when you have a strong suspicion that the time for prayer will exit, the time for prayer will leave, and you still would not have prayed unless you do tayammum and you pray, only then can you do tayammum. Okay, you understand the scenario? Clear, everyone? Inshallah. Tayyib. So, when there is a scarcity of water, or there is no water, and the time for prayer is about to leave, these are the two conditions that are required for a person to do tayammum in. And it doesn't matter if a person is in the state of janaba or minor impurity. Because, you know, janaba is major impurity, and there is minor impurity. It doesn't matter. Tayammum lifts both of them. Tayammum lifts both janaba and wudu. The same act, the same thing. Okay. So, how do you do tayammum? How do you do tayammum? Well, another case where tayammum is allowed actually is, for example, Brother Imran's cast here. Okay, he would have to do tayammum over the cast because he can't put water on the cast. Okay, so you're allowed to do tayammum over that. So if a person is in a medical emergency in that he cannot touch water, okay, or water will not reach him, then he should just do tayammum. Okay, so suppose someone has a disease, yani, where you cannot do tayammum, okay, you cannot touch water. In this case, he is allowed also to do tayammum. So in this case, or how do you do tayammum? Very simple. The way you do tayammum is that you tap your hands on dusty ground. It has to be dust, sand, soil, something. So you can't do it on the carpet. You can't do it on the wall. No, it should be dust. Okay, you touch your hand on dusty ground, or if you like sand, you know, I mean, like for example, outside here. I mean, as long as there's some type of dust or some type of soil or some type of you know, pure substance, and it has to be pure. For example, if someone's urinated there, you can't obviously tayammum from that. Okay, from pure sand, you tap your hands, right, and you wash it until not to the elbows but to the wrists. Not wash it, but you just rub it. Tayammum is symbolic. Realize, tayammum is symbolic. You're not really going to clean anything. It's just symbolic. That you wash your hands like this, okay, to the elbows. Just wash them like this to the elbows, okay? To the wrists, excuse me. Jazakallah khair. To the wrists, not to the elbows. You don't have to go all the way down. And then, with the same wipe, if you want, you can wipe your hand or your face, okay? With the same wipe, with the same hitting of the ground, you can wipe your face. And if you want to hit again, you can hit again and wipe your face. That's it. You have finished your tayammum. The point is, tayammum is symbolic. It is not an actual ghusl or anything. It is symbolic. Okay? Now, obviously you should do it in that order. Just like wudu, you have to do it in that order. Likewise, in tayammum, you have to do it in that order. And also, again, as for all religious acts, you need to have what? Niyyah. As for all religious acts, no religious act does not require niyyah. Every single religious act requires a niyyah. So likewise, if you want to do tayammum, you have to have the niyyah, you go to pure sand, you have to have the conditions for tayammum, which means that you don't have water, or you can't use water, or the time for prayer is going to go out. Gently put your hand to the earth, make sure that there's, you know, you've just tested. You don't have to make your hands muddy or soily, it's just symbolic. You just touch your hand, and then you wash it to the wrists, not wash it, but rub it to the wrist, and then you rub your face. Okay? It's just, yeah, it does it just once. It's just symbolic. It's just symbolic. The point of tayammum is so that you don't feel bad praying in a state of janabah, for example. Suppose you're in a state of janabah, and you have to pray, okay, and you don't have water. So, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala could have said, there is no tayammum, just pray. But so that when you do tayammum, it makes you feel that, okay, now I'm, you know, at least temporarily pure. You know, it's just psychological. It's a mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He has given us this act of tayammum. Now, what breaks tayammum? Same things that break wudu and some more factors. Same things that break wudu. All of these factors that we mentioned that break wudu, they also break tayammum. However, there's another factor that breaks wudu, tayammum, and doesn't break wudu. And that is what? Yes. When you find water, exactly. So suppose you did tayammum, okay? You did it for a dhuhr. Most scholars would say that when the time for asr comes, you have to do tayammum again, but this is not the correct opinion. No, you don't have to do tayammum again. Your first tayammum will count. But suppose when the time for asr came, you found water. In this case, your tayammum is null and void. It is broken. So you have to do a full ghusl or a full wudu, whatever you needed to do. If you needed to do a ghusl, you have to do ghusl. If you needed to do a wudu, you have to do wudu with that water. So basically, when you find water, your tayammum breaks. Obviously, if you pass gas and wind and feet, all of these things also break your tayammum, just like wudu. But on top of that, if you find water, this too automatically breaks your wudu. As soon as you find water, it breaks your wudu. So if you have to do ghusl, you do ghusl. And if you have to do tayammum, you do tayammum. The verse for tayammum in the Quran is Surah Nisa, verse 43. That if you don't find water and you are sick or on a journey, then tayammamu. Then perform tayammum with pure sand, with pure soil, and wash your wujuh and wash your hands and your faces with it. All you have to do is just wipe your hands and your faces, and that is tayammum. Okay. After that, we get to, let me see if there's something left. How much time do we have left? 15 minutes. Okay, and then question and answers. We have 15 minutes of lecture. Okay, inshallah, we can then finish. We can finish the chapter concerning women's blood. Okay. Taba'an, women's blood is a topic that is of utmost importance. It's very important to study this because it affects every single woman on the face of this earth. It affects our brother, our sisters, our wives, our mothers, our daughters. We have to know the rulings pertaining to this. Okay, for example, I know of a brother that when he got married, he didn't even know that a woman in menstruation doesn't have to pray. He was going to force his wife to pray, and getting angry at her, why aren't you praying? Because he was ignorant of the fact that women, they don't have to pray in menstruation. So the point is, the brothers have to know these rulings, and they have to be able to, you know, instruct their wives and instruct their daughters, and the sisters have to know the rulings even more necessarily than the brothers do, so that they can worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala properly. Tayyib. Know that women's blood is divided into three categories. Okay? No blood comes from a woman's private part except that it is one of three categories. Like obviously it comes from the private part. If a woman is bleeding, it's just like a man bleeding from outside. But from the private part, this is what we talk about when we talk about women's blood. Okay? So there are three categories of women's blood. The first category is called hayd, or menstruation. Okay? So the first type of blood is the type of that is called hayd or menstruation. The second category is called nifas, or postnatal bleeding. Postnatal bleeding. The third category is called istihada. Istihada. Okay? Istihada, which is everything else besides the first two. Okay? Anything that is besides the first two is called istihada. Each one has its own rulings and its own, whatchamacallit, yani ahkam, yani rulings. Okay? Firstly, with regards to menstruation. Many scholars, they have given a minimum age limit to menstruation and a maximum age limit. And they have given the minimum time that a woman can menstruate and the maximum time, you know, and the minimum time in between the two menstruations. And all of the four madhahibs, they have different figures for these. Okay? However, the correct opinion is that the Quran and Sunnah is silent about this issue. So we don't put forth numbers. Many scholars say that the minimum menstruation is 1 day or 3 days, and the maximum is 7 days or 10 days or 15 days, and so on and so forth. But the correct opinion, like the opinion of Shaykh Uthaymeen and Shaykh Baz and others, and without a doubt it is correct because the Quran and Sunnah didn't come forth with these numbers. The correct opinion is that there is no minimum length of menstruation, nor is there a maximum length of menstruation. Okay? Nor is there a minimum amount of time between the two menstruation periods, nor is there a maximum length of time between the two menstruation periods. This is all left to the nature of the woman. So there is no minimum or maximum. However, there is a narration from Aisha which gives a minimum age for menstruation. That Aisha said that no woman reaches the age of purity before the age of 9. So then, because Aisha said this, we say then that any girl that sees blood before the age of 9, okay, this is not menstruation. This is istihaba. And it obviously cannot be nifas. It's istihaba. Okay, so therefore it has different rulings. So menstruation then, the first age for it is 9. The last age, there is no last age. A woman can be 60 years old and it is still possible that she might have a menstruation. Okay? There is no maximum age. The minimum time for menstruation, in other words, each menstrual cycle, there is no minimum time. It could be a day, it could be less, it could be more. Again, the maximum time, there is no authentic maximum time. Okay? Likewise, the minimum time between two periods. You know that women have periods roughly once every month. It is possible they can have them maybe twice a month. It is possible we can have once every 2 or 3 months. The point is, the scholars have discussed what is the minimum time between two periods and what is the maximum time between two periods. Once again, these figures are not based on the Quran and Sunnah, so the correct opinion is that there is no minimum or maximum time. Okay? Now, how do women know menstrual blood? Well, obviously there are certain characteristics, the smell and the color. And the texture, the women, they know these things, okay? Every woman knows that menstrual blood, it has a certain smell, it has a certain texture, it has a certain color to it that is unique and separates it from other types of blood. So when a woman starts receiving this type of blood, then she is not allowed to pray. She is not allowed to pray. She's not allowed to pray, okay? But we said about the Quran, she should not recite the Quran unless, what? She has a habit of before. She cannot touch the Mus'haf, obviously. And the important thing, that all of us should be very careful of, she cannot be sexually approached. Meaning that you cannot have intercourse with a woman who is in her period, in her menstruation. It is haram to have intercourse with a woman in her period. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has cursed the one who has sex with his wife during her period. Okay? This is a curse of Allah upon this person. So we have to be very careful. Now the question arises, can a man enjoy his wife in other ways? The answer is yes. He can enjoy his wife in any way he wishes sexually, as long as he doesn't enter her sexually. He cannot enter her sexually. Okay. So the point is, the Prophet ﷺ, when his wives were menstruating, he would command them to cover their private parts with a cloth. and then he would do whatever he pleased with him. Aisha said that when we were menstruating, the Prophet would command us to cover our private parts with a cloth, tighten a cloth on a private part, in other words, so that you will not enter the woman. And then after that, you can do what you wish. Okay? So as long as you not enter the woman, you can do anything you want after that. But you are not allowed to enter the woman. If you enter the woman, then Allah's curse is upon you at this time, and you have to give charity. You have to give charity as an expiation. You have to give a gold coin or a dinar or a dirham. You have to give it, a dirham or half a dirham. In other words, you have to give some charity if you enter a woman in this state. And you have to repent to Allah because you have done something that is haram. Okay? So these are the rulings pertaining to menstruation, is that you cannot, a woman cannot pray. She cannot fast, obviously, also. She cannot fast. Okay? And obviously, she cannot touch the Quran and do tawaf and everything that we mentioned before. Okay? But the new things in here is that she cannot pray or fast. Okay? And for the man, he cannot have intercourse with the woman during the menstruation. There are three things then that you should be aware of, including the act that we mentioned about wudu. Is that obviously the woman cannot do those things that are mentioned in wudu, which is what? What can a man not do without wudu? We just mentioned them 10 minutes ago. Pray, touch the mushaf, tawaf. Obviously the woman in the state of menstruation cannot obviously do these things, you know. Likewise, she cannot enter the masjid and do the things that are prohibited in janabah. On top of that, the man cannot have sex with her, and prayer and fasting is made haram. Likewise, divorce is not allowed during menstruation. And we're gonna, if Allah wills, and we finish up salah and zakah and fasting, and if we have maybe 3 or 4 lessons left, we're gonna talk about the rulings of divorce, because it's something that everyone should know, and many people make a big mistakes when they're making divorce. They make life very difficult for them and for their spouses. So it is not allowed. It is haram. It is sinful for the man to divorce his wife while she is in a state of menstruation. And this is by ijma' or by unanimous consensus of all the scholars of Islam, that a man is sinful for divorcing his wife while she is menstruating. So this too is prohibited. Okay? Now obviously we mentioned that the woman, she knows her cycle, so she bases her rulings, these rulings based on her cycle. She knows, for example, that she's going to start after 23 days or 27 days or 25 days, and in general her period lasts for 5 days or 6 days or 7 days or 8 days. So she bases these rulings on those cycles. However, supposing she has other types of blood besides menstruation, this is now where the problems arise. Menstruation is very clear. You know, you can't do this, okay? You have to make up the fasting, and you don't have to make up the prayer. Everyone knows this, right? When a woman is in menstruation, even though she cannot fast and pray, she has to make up the prayer, the fast, and she doesn't have to make up the prayer. This is based on the hadith of Aisha, in which a woman came to the Prophet to Aisha and asked her about this, and she said that the Prophet used to command us to make up the fast, and he would not command us to make up the prayer. So this is also of the great mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, is that He has allowed the woman, that He has forgiven the woman prayer. He has forgiven the woman the fact that she has to offer prayer, but He has not forgiven her of the fasting, so she must make up the fasting as soon as she finishes her menstruation. Not necessarily as soon as, but before the next Ramadan comes. Within the next year, she should finish her obligatory fasting before that time. But the point is, the questions or the problems arise when the woman get non-menstrual blood. Okay, so how many types of blood are there, we said?
Three.
The first type is? Hayd, menstruation. The second type is? Nifas. Nifas is also very easy. Nifas is postnatal blood. In other words, the baby comes out, blood's going to come out with it. And blood is going to continue to come out for a period of time, a week, 2 weeks, in general around 30 days to 40 days. Okay, so this is nifas, and the exact same rulings apply as in hayd. So you cannot have intercourse, they cannot do this, they cannot do that. Same rulings. So they're, for practical purposes, hayd and nifas have the same rulings. The only difference is that nifas has a cutoff point, and that is 40 days. After 40 days, if any blood comes out, it is not considered nifas. So she must take a shower on the 40th day. 40th day of what? 40th day of what? The month? The year? After she gave birth, obviously. So you count from the day that the child was born. After 40 days, if the blood is still flowing out, she must take a shower and resume her normal life. And after that, her blood is considered istihaba and not nifas. Okay? Suppose the bleeding stops before 40 days. Suppose it stops on the 30th day. What should she do then? Obviously, if it stops before 40 days, then obviously she's out of nifas. Okay, so she finishes the nifas and she continues her normal life. Okay, the problem arises though, like we said, the other types of blood. In other words, hayd and nifas are pretty clear. How about other types of blood, the ones that occur beyond these two types? This is where the problem arises. So firstly, we should realize that if blood is not hayd or nifas, it's istihadah. Any blood that is not hayd and not nifas, automatically it's qualified as istihadah. What are the rulings of istihadah? We're going to define the istihadah blood next, but firstly, let's talk about the rulings. How does the istihadah woman differ from the woman in menstruation and nifas? Okay. The istihadah woman, for all practical purposes, is like the normal woman. It's as if she is not in her hayd and nifas. So, she can fast. Or in fact, she is obligated to fast if it's istihadah. She's obligated to pray. Her husband can approach her, even though it might be wiser not to, but it is allowed for her husband to have intercourse with her if it is istihadah blood. If it is istihadah blood, her husband can approach her. So for all practical purposes, the istihadah woman is just like the normal non-menstruating and non-nifas woman, except for one factor. And that is that when the time for prayer comes, since she is always emitting najasa, right? Since she is always emitting najasa, in this case, she has to do wudu even if she had wudu. Even if she had wudu, she didn't break it, she has to do wudu again. Right before the prayer. Right before the prayer, like as the latest time she can afford to make wudu, she makes wudu and then she comes and prays. And the Prophet said that the woman should tie their private parts very tightly. So that, in the sense that they should have a pad in our times or something that will prevent the blood from going to the masjid or something. But apart from that, the istihadah woman, the rulings pertaining to the istihadah woman are exactly the same as that of a normal woman. Except that she is required, she is obligated to do wudu for every single prayer. So the time for dhuhr comes, she has to make wudu. After time comes, she didn't break her wudu, she still has to do wudu. Okay? And we mentioned, what else is she encouraged to do? We mentioned this a few minutes ago. She's encouraged to take a bath for every prayer. But she is encouraged, is not obligated for her. She is only encouraged to take a bath for every prayer. Okay? Now the crucial question though, the crucial point though, is how do we know what types of blood are what? This is now where all the difference between arises. Everyone understands hayd and what it is? It's the menstrual blood. Everyone understands nifas, what it is? It's postnatal bleeding. The ahkam or the rulings pertaining to hayl and nifas are exactly the same, except for one difference. What is that? Nifas has a 40-day limit to it. Okay. Whereas hayl, there is no minimum or maximum to it. Except obviously, if the woman is in continual bleeding, we know that this is not menstruation. It has to be istihadah. So the problem arises, or the different scenarios arise. How do we differentiate between hayl blood and istihadah blood? Nifas blood is very easy. It comes after childbirth. You don't have any problem with nifas blood. Okay? So nifas is never a problem. If a woman is bleeding after childbirth, this is considered nifas. When she stops bleeding, she's now back to normal. If she bleeds till 40 days, after 40 days is istihadah. So when a woman is in nifas, there is no problem. There can never be a problem with a woman in nifas. Because after the 40-day limit is over, either she's bleeding or she's not. If she's not bleeding, fine. Take a shower and you're back to your normal life. If she is bleeding, then that blood will be qualified as what? Looks like the brothers are lost here. Are you understanding what's going on? Seriously. It's very important. I mean, every one of you will have to put this into use. With your wife, with your daughters. You have to know this type of stuff. It's clear? Everyone's clear? Right, three types of blood. Nifas will never give you a problem, okay? The problem will be between hayd and istihadah. Hayd and istihadah. Now here, this is where the scholars say that there are three things that the woman should do. Now, I'm going to speak very generally here, and obviously the woman will realize more than the men what's going on. Firstly, she should look at the characteristics of the blood, okay? She should look at the characteristics of the blood. Women know that menstrual blood has a certain texture, a certain color, and a certain smell to it that other blood doesn't. So if she is bleeding continuously, she goes back to this criterion, that she will look at this type of blood. So whatever is this type of blood, she will count as her, what? Menstruation. And whatever is not this type of blood is istihadah. So the woman, now suppose she's bleeding for 20 or 30 days. This is obviously not her menstruation. Menstruations are not, she knows that this is not her menstruation. So what does she do? She looks at the texture and the color and the what was left? the smell of the blood. Okay? She looks at this. And every woman knows that, in general, you can differentiate between hayd blood and istihadha blood. So that blood, which has a different texture, or a different color, or a different smell, she knows that this is her hayd, so she stops her prayer, her husband cannot approach her, she stops fasting, so on and so forth. When the texture changes, when the color changes, when the smell changes, now she resumes her normal life. She takes a shower, and she ignores the blood coming out, except for the fact that she has to do wudu for every prayer. Clear or not? Yes or no? Clear? Imran, clear? Okay? Okay, so this is the first criterion. Suppose now, theoretically, that she cannot differentiate between the different types of blood. Suppose she cannot differentiate. Suppose that the criterion are the same. In this case, she goes back to her previous habit. So suppose now the woman started menstruating at the age of, let's say, 11 or 12 or 13, whatever. Suppose until she's 25, she has a normal habit that every 23rd or 24th day her cycle will begin and it will last 6 days or 7 days. I'm saying or because the woman knows each one is different. Each woman has her own. It's pretty much exact. It's not exact, but it's pretty much exact. After 23 or 24 days, her hayd is going to start and it's going to last for 6 or 7 days. Okay? And then when she reaches 25 or 26 or whatever age she reaches, then she starts bleeding continuously. So she knows that it's hayd and istihadha. And she can't differentiate based on these characteristics. Then she goes back to her habit. It seems I'm losing you guys. Is it clear or not? Really, seriously. Huh? No? Yeah, exactly. Whatever her habit was before she started her istihadha, whatever her habit was before she started continually bleeding, she'll go back to that. But she'll only do that if the first criterion wasn't met. In other words, she can't differentiate based on color or texture or smell. If she can do that, she goes to the first one. If she can differentiate, then the strongest proof that this is hayd is the blood itself. Suppose she can't. Suppose the blood is the same all the way through. In this case, she goes back to her previous habit. Okay, so she will know, for example, that I have my menstruation every 24 days, and it lasts 6 days. So she'll just base on that. 24 days is istihadha, 6 days hayd. 24 days is istihadha, 6 days hayd, until she gets back to her normal cycle and her bleeding stops. Okay, now the third scenario is suppose she doesn't have a habit. In other words, either she doesn't remember it, or she just started bleeding when she's 9, 10 years old, and she's continuously bleeding. She doesn't have a previous habit. What does she do now? Obviously, the hayd cannot be for 30 days long or for the whole year long. It has to be istihadha and hayd. What does she do now? In this case, she looks at women who are closely related to her of a similar age and body structure, body size, and she bases her habit on hers. She bases her habit on the other person's habit. Okay? Because in one hadith, the Prophet ﷺ said that, let me see if I can find this hadith. Yeah, so the Prophet ﷺ said to Hamana bint Jahsh, right? Hamana bint Jahsh. She said, Ya Rasulullah, I am a woman that has a lot of istihadha. A lot of blood comes out. Okay? So the Prophet ﷺ said, wipe it away with a piece of cloth, with cotton. So she said, it's more than that. So the Prophet ﷺ said, take a cloth and put it on your private parts, like the pads of today. Okay? So that she said, it is even more than that. So she was really bleeding a lot. Okay? And by the way, the same woman, when she used to pray in the Prophet's masjid, the woman would put a bucket underneath her. That's how much blood would be coming out. To make sure that the masjid did not become najis, okay? So she had a type of problem with so much blood would come out that she would have a cup or a bucket underneath her that would take this blood out. The woman would put that there for her. So she said, it is even more than that. So the Prophet said, فَتَلَجَّمِي, right? Which means basically, you bridle yourself basically, that you tie something like a belt, and then you tie between that belt so that you basically block off the exits for the blood to go out. Okay? So it's like a type of underwear, if you like, is that you tie yourself tightly to make sure that the blood does not spread out. Okay? And then the Prophet said, I will tell you something that will, make it easier for you, but that will tell you what to do in this case. He said that this istihadha is from the shaitan. So count your hayd as 6 or 7 days. Allah knows how long your hayd is. This is what the Prophet ﷺ said. Your hayd is in the knowledge of Allah, how long it is. So count your hayd as 6 or 7 days, and then take a shower. And then it is as if you are pure. So every time you come to pray, then take a wudu. Okay? So Hamana then, when she heard this hadith, in order to be more pure and more perfect, she would take a ghusl, not just a wudu, every time the time for prayer came. So this shows that it is preferred for the mustahaba woman to do ghusl every time the time for prayer comes, but it is not obligated. She can do just wudu, and it is sufficient. The point is though, the point of this hadith is that the Prophet ﷺ told Hamana to count your haid 6 or 7 days. So the scholars say, the Prophet ﷺ wouldn't command her 6 or 7 days and leave it to her for no reason. No, what he is instructing her to do is to look at women of her size, her nature, her cousins, her sisters, and see, do they menstruate 5 days or 6 days or 7 days, and base her hayd on their hayd. You see what I'm saying? Is that basically look at women who are closely related to her, and then act her hayd accordingly to that. Now this would only be resorted to when? Firstly, when? When will this be resorted to? When she can't tell the difference between the hayd and the stahada. Secondly, when? She has no habit beforehand. So when you don't have criterion to differentiate between this hayd and the istihaba, and you don't have a previous habit, then and only then do you resort to this as a last resort. That you go to your sisters, your cousins, or people that are close to you, or women of your ethnicity, because hayd also depends on ethnicity, women of your culture, women of your size, and you base your hayd on their hayd. So whatever is their hayd is your hayd, and then after that, you are in a state of istihaba. Okay? Likewise, the ending, we've finished the ahkam of hayd and nifas and istihaba, but a point that I forgot to mention when I was talking about hayd is that all the sisters know that the hayd ends when they see the white material or the white discharge, the yellowish discharge. Before this, the hayd does not end. We're talking about normal hayd now. I forgot to mention this when we're talking about hayd. Is that whatever occurs after this discharge is irrelevant. Suppose the sister sees this discharge, this yellowish or this whitish discharge, and every sister knows what this is. Suppose she sees this discharge, that means that her hayd is finished. So whatever comes after this, yellow or reddish or brownish, it can be ignored. Aisha said that we used to consider yellowish and reddish discharge after this whitish fluid as nothing. Obviously, if it occurs before the white fluid, it is part of your hayd. But if it occurs after this whitish or yellowish fluid, then it is not a part of your hayd. And you can ignore it absolutely. So if you took a shower after this yellowish discharge and something came out, you can ignore it. Okay. With that, we have concluded the topic of hayd and nifas and istihada. And tomorrow, inshallah, we will start off with adhan and iqama and salah. Alhamdulillah, we're going at a good pace. I'm happy. We're going at this pace. Inshallah, we want to finish up. Our goal, my goal, is to finish with you salah, zakah, and psalm, and go over the basics of marriage and divorce. The real basics of marriage and divorce, okay? And we hope that inshallah Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with this knowledge, and He causes us to act upon it. Innahu wa sami'ur alim. Okay. Questions. We have a lot of questions. Oh, read it out there.
Okay, once again, ask the brothers to, they can ask afterwards too, so for every two or three questions from the sisters, we'll take one from the brothers. The first, and
also, it's the sisters' topic today too, so they should be given more.
The first has been asked a few times, and it's referring to Sunday school at the masjid. And one question was asked as a teacher and one as a student: if the sister is on her menses, can she come into the masjid for a class?
Really, the scholars have been asked this question, and they say that something should be arranged, you know? Some type of room or some type of thing should be arranged where the sisters do not have to enter the masjid. This is because the hadith is explicit, that I don't allow women to enter the masjid. But we have to realize, firstly, that many places where Sunday school takes place, this isn't qualified as a masjid. Okay, it might qualify as a musalla, but it doesn't qualify as a masjid. A musalla is a place where two or three prayers might be offered in the day, or maybe even four prayers. But the masjid is a place where it's set aside specially for the worship of Allah, like this place here. If fajr is offered here, I don't know. If fajr is offered here and five prayers are offered here, then this is a masjid. Otherwise, if it's not offered, five prayers are not offered, then it's not a masjid, it's a musalla. So sisters can enter this place, okay? Really, I this requires a fatwa. I mean, if the sister cannot find a place, and she's a teacher or she's a student, and it is only a masjid that she can go into, is she allowed to go into this place or not? This requires a fatwa. And I mean, you know, because the general ruling is that no, it is not allowed. But this is a type of darura or a type of unique circumstance, and I'm not qualified to give fatwa. So I asked the sister firstly to see whether this really is a masjid or not. If it's not a masjid, don't worry about it. Okay? Or if it is a masjid, can you arrange with the organizers? And realize this is the opinion of the vast majority of scholars, the four madahib, they all say this, you know. So it's not something unique we're coming out with. This is the opinion of the vast majority of scholars of Islam. It is not allowed for the menstruating woman to enter the masjid. So if it is a masjid, then try to get the organizers or the people in charge to arrange a room. And remember, the entrance room, for example, this hallway here would not be considered the masjid outside of this. The masjid is for when the carpet starts, if fajr is offered here. Okay. Likewise, I'm sure the sisters, they might have a little room where they enter and where they take their shoes off. Try moving the class there. Take your shoes off somewhere else. Okay. This is not the masjid. The masjid is that place that is set aside for the prayer and where five times prayers are offered. Okay. So if she cannot find a place other than the masjid and the class are being offered there, I ask the sister to go to an alim and get a fatwa from this alim. No.
You said that in the situation where there was a habit or something like that, that the woman could wear gloves and then read. Why does she have to wear gloves if her hands are already clean?
We mentioned that the one who is not in the state of wudu cannot touch the Quran. This is why. So the woman who is in her state of menstruation obviously is not in the state of wudu, because she is releasing najis. Menstrual blood is najis, one of the extreme types of najis. Okay? So she is releasing najis, she is obviously not in the state of wudu. Therefore, she cannot touch the Quran. This is why.
Some people say they may get sick or they're not capable of lifting their legs in the situation of the sinks today to make wudu. So instead they make tayammum. Can you tell me how strict we should be when we are crossing the line, and in what situation tayammum can be made? Can it be made in this situation?
No, I cannot see tayammum being made in this situation because of the fact that you can wash yourself in other ways. You can wash yourself, for example, do wudu from the tap and then wash your feet in the bath area, the shower area, that you don't have to lift your feet, you lower your feet there and do it. Or, you don't have to do wudu from the tap. Go outside and do it in the backyard with the hose. Okay? This is not an exception for sure. If you have a problem lifting your foot, you really have a problem, and it is a medical, discomfort or very severe for you to lift your feet, then fine. You don't have to do wudu from the sink. It's not fard to do wudu from the sink, it is fard to do wudu. So you have to do wudu in other ways. Go out to the backyard, do it from even pour water. Even pour water from the commode or something. Pour water onto your feet in the place where you take the shower area. I don't see this as a problem. Only when it is a problem to touch water. When the doctors advise you, for example, it's a severe burn, and they say don't let anything touch, not even water, nothing. In this case, do wudu over all the area except that which has been burnt or whatever, and over that you do tayammum. So we have to be strict with regards to this. There is no leniency in this strict with regards.
If one is in a state of janaba, can one listen to the Quranic tapes?
Yes, one can listen to Quranic tapes. The recitation is to recite the Quran. Also, I'd like to point out, many scholars, they say that, suppose a person is going to sleep and he's in a state of janaba, right? And he is in the habit of, for example, saying Qul Huwallahu Ahad, and those adhkar that is sunnah to say before going to sleep, many scholars say that this is forgiven. It's something very small, very light, they can go over it. What is prohibited is that you just, for no reason or for the worship of Allah, it's not your, you just recite the Quran instead of janaba. But some scholars make an exception for those adhkar or those dhikrs that you do before going to sleep. No.
Yeah, there's some questions on divorce, and this the brother said was going to be taught later. So if you could just keep these for now.
Let's see. What is that? What if you were divorced before menstruation started? Well, obviously, if you divorce, that's a proper divorce before menstruation has started. If the husband divorces you before menstruation, we have to. If you were divorced before menstruation, right? Then obviously, this is a proper divorce. We're going to get to the rulings of divorce, inshallah. And if we don't, perhaps those that are interested, I can do something in my house or something, because I'm going to be offering classes in my house after this 1 month long too. So perhaps we can do a marriage and divorce there. Okay. No.
How do we know how the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam did ghusl? Did someone water him, or did he tell people after he did it?
One of the great mercies of Allah Subhanahu Wa Ta'ala, and one of the great benefits of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam marrying more than one wife, is that these wives of his are mothers. They were able to preserve for us the smallest detail of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So it was the Prophet's wives who narrated to us how the Prophet did the ghusl, because obviously only they could see the Prophet, and no one else could see the Prophet. So Aisha narrated to us in a very explicit hadith. She's the one that said that, you know, he used to wash his private parts and then wipe his hand. Umm Salama also narrated to us how the Prophet did the ghusl. So it is of the mercy. The scholars say one of the benefits of the Prophet having more than four wives was that since he was the Prophet, people needed to preserve his message. People needed to preserve even the most detailed intricacy. It was, if you think about it, imagine if Aisha had not told us the Prophet ghusl, how would we know the Prophet ghusl? Okay. Likewise, if Aisha had not told us that the Prophet would kiss some of his wives and go to the masjid, we would not know for the rest of our eternity. We would not know is it allowed for us to touch our wives, does it break our wudu or not? You know. So it is of the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that the Prophet was blessed with so many wives that they could all preserve the religion of Islam, and it was through them, like we said, Aisha and Umm Salam and others, that narrated to us the Prophet's wudu. Now.
Is wearing gloves only necessary for the mushaf or also books of tafsir?
No, it's only necessary for the mushaf. You can touch the books of tafsir without gloves. But it's obviously encouraged to do so. But it's not necessary. It's only for the mushaf.
If you have dreadlocks, you cannot take your hair down, and you can just barely wet your roots as much as you can, is this okay?
Might be a very ignorant question. What are dreadlocks? Oh. Same thing as braided hair, isn't it?
It's a little different. It's a little thicker.
Yeah, it's the same thing as braided hair. So just make the roots of the hair wet and go over the rest of it with water.
I've heard that the majority of scholars have said it is okay for menstruating women to touch the mushaf. Then how come you said you have to have wudu to touch?
No, this is not correct. The vast majority of scholars said it is haram for the woman to touch the mushaf. A very small minority said that it is allowed. There is a difference of opinion, but the vast majority of the ulama of the past and of the present, they have said that it is haram for the woman in menstruation and the man who doesn't have wudu, and the man obviously in state of janaba and the woman in state of janaba, to touch the mushaf. This is the opinion of the vast majority. But there is a difference of opinion. I know that some of the modern scholars, they allow the woman to touch the mushaf in the state of janaba and the state of menstruation. But this is, like I said, the minority opinion. And I don't agree with the minority opinion in this case. No. Yeah, it might not be appropriate. No.
When you were talking about ghusl due to ejecting seminal fluid, what if a woman has an orgasm without ejecting any fluid? This is very possible. I don't mean when the man enters. I mean if the husband touches you in any way and you reach orgasm, but no fluid. Does this necessitate ghusl?
Allahu a'lam, if I'm not mistaken, yes, it does necessitate ghusl, and I will, inshallah, confirm for you. But the point is, even if a man, he has an orgasm, but nothing comes out, okay? The point is he has to feel the orgasm, even if nothing comes out, or he himself prevents the sperm from coming out, it still necessitates ghusl. What necessitates ghusl is the actual orgasm, whether something comes out or not. And I will, inshallah, check this for you, but I am pretty sure that it does necessitate ghusl, and Allah knows best.
Is it also recommended to make wudu when you're very angry?
Yes, it is recommended to make wudu when you're very angry. Another point when you should make wudu is when you're very angry. Add that to the list. Did I mention the list of things? No, I didn't even mention this. This is us, of course. I didn't mention when it's recommended to do wudu. It's recommended to do wudu a number of times. Perhaps you can add that to your notes. It's recommended to do wudu for every salah, even if you have wudu. Okay, we'll take your notes out again. Sorry, I forgot that chapter. It's another chapter. Okay, all notes are open. Okay, sorry about this, guys. It is recommended to have wudu at all times. This is just something that's recommended. It's also recommended to do wudu for every salah, even if you have wudu. Okay, yani you renew your wudu. You renew your wudu for every act of salah. Okay. Likewise, for every act of worship, for tawaf or anything, if you have wudu already, it's still recommended for you to do wudu. Another time that it is recommended to do wudu is, can someone mention it to me? Huh? If you're angry, we just mentioned that, if you're angry. Why? Because the Prophet ﷺ said that shaitan is created out of the fire of hell, and water destroys fire. Or water extinguishes fire, so when one of you gets angry, do wudu, okay? Another time is before you go to sleep. Very good. The Prophet said, whoever goes to sleep in a state of wudu and he wakes up at night and prays, Allah SWT will accept his prayer. Yes. Exactly. Another time that is recommended to do wudu, okay, is if you've had intercourse with your wife and you did not do ghusl and you wanted to have another intercourse before doing ghusl. In this case, it is recommended to do wudu again. Okay? The way I just said it. If you want to return to your wife without having performed ghusl, okay? If you want to have another intercourse with your wife after you've already had one and before you've had ghusl. So you, and this is also some scholars say for the woman also, is that it's going to be the second time. The first time you don't have to have ghusl. Okay, the second time it's sunnah. It is not obligatory. It's sunnah for the second time. If you want to come back to your wife, is that you do wudu again. The Prophet ﷺ said that whoever has intercourse with his wife and then wishes to have another intercourse, then he should do ghusl because this is better for him and it will make him more energetic in the return. Okay? It will make him more energetic in the return. So the brothers, when they have a second time, it's sunnah for them to do wudu. Now this type of wudu, by the way, there's a strange thing here. This type of wudu, by the way, it does not break with any of the factors that we mentioned before. So if you pass wind, or urinate, or stool, or anything, this type of wudu is not broken. Why? Because it's not even the wudu for the purification, it's a wudu for another purpose. So this might be a trick question on the exam, so pay attention. I might ask, what type of wudu is there that does not break with, you know, gas, or urine, or stool, or anything? It is this type of wudu. What breaks this type of wudu? Having intercourse again. So if you have intercourse for a second time, and you want to go back for a third time, then in this case, it is recommended to do wudu again. Okay?
Ma'am. I think this question was asked yesterday, but it's, are we permitted to look at our spouse's private parts? Is there modesty in that?
I thank the person for asking that question. This is on everyone's mind, and people are embarrassed to ask this. And like we said over and over again, we should not be embarrassed or shy or modest to ask that question, because it is very practical, and everyone wants to know it. So I thank the person, the brother and sister, for asking that question. There are some weak hadith that mention that it is not allowed to look at the private parts of your wife and vice versa. There are some weak hadith, but the correct opinion without any doubt is that it is allowed to look at the private parts of one's spouse. It is allowed to look at the private parts of one's spouse. And this is proven in many narrations. The narration that we just quoted of Aisha radiallahu anha about the Prophet's ghusl. How did she know the Prophet's ghusl? How did she know the Prophet's ghusl? Except if she saw the Prophet ﷺ perform ghusl. Likewise, it goes against the whole point of getting married. The whole point of getting married is that your wife serves as a barrier between you and other women. You don't want to be attracted to other women. Therefore, you enjoy your wife. Vice versa, the wife enjoys her husband. She doesn't want to be, let shaitan deceive her into being attracted to other men. So she uses her husband as a barrier. So she takes enjoyment from her husband. And full enjoyment is taken by fully enjoying one's spouse. So there is no doubt that the correct opinion is that it is allowed to look at the private parts of the spouse, despite the fact that some of the scholars, they use these da'if hadith and say that it is not allowed. Another point that allows this, or clearly shows it, is there a narration in Ibn Hibban, Sahih Ibn Hibban, in which a man asked Aisha radiallahu anha, he said, I have something very embarrassing to ask you. And she said, Ask my son and do not be embarrassed. Again, it shows you over and over again, we should be mature when it comes to these topics, realize that there is no, as long as we talk about it in the proper way, we don't crack dirty jokes about it, we understand the seriousness of it, we don't laugh at it, it is part of our religion to discuss. So she said to this man, and he was a man, and it's an embarrassing topic, she said, ask and don't feel embarrassed. So he said, can I look at the private parts of my wife? So she said, oh my son, the Prophet and I used to take a bath together. And we would be racing each other with the water. Because remember, the water, like I said, would be in this cup or some very small container. So Aisha would tell the Prophet, leave some for me, leave some for me. Because the Prophet would be taking a bath, and obviously the water is being, used. So Aisha would say, tell the Prophet, leave some for me, leave some for me. I need to also do ghusl. And so Aisha quoted this hadith when she was asked the question, can we look at the private parts of our spouses? So this shows you then, not only does the hadith show you this, but also the context in which she said it in, it shows you that it is allowed to look at the private parts of one's spouse.
Does the Quran only with the English meaning count as mushaf?
No. The Quran with the English meaning does not count as the mushaf. So if you have a Quran, a translation of the Quran that is not the Quran. Now if you have the Arabic text and the English text at the same book, in this case you have to look. Is the Arabic more than the English? If it is, then it's the Quran. If it's less, then you don't have to have wudu to touch it. Okay? That's how the scholars defined it. Because there has to be a fine, there has to be a criterion. If the Arabic text takes up more space and is more than the translation, then in that case, it is the Quran. And if it takes up less space, or the translation or the tafsir takes up more space, then in that case, you can touch it without wudu.
Can you listen to the surah with sajdas in them, like surah 32, when on periods, can you make sajda?
Yes, of course you can listen to the Qur'an when you're in the period. No one says that you cannot listen to the Qur'an in your state of period or janabah. The point is you cannot recite it. However, when a sajda comes, then for sure not in the state of janabah, nor in the state of hayd, but some scholars say you don't have to have wudu to do sajda. And most said you did have to have wudu to do sajda. Okay. So there's a difference even about wudu, do you need it for sajda or not? But in hayd and in janabah, no, don't do sajda. Obviously realize, doing the sajda is not obligatory anyway, it's sunnah. So even if you had full wudu, you don't have to do sajda. It's just sunnah to do sajda at that time.
This question's about utensils. You said that we can use the utensils of the non-Muslims if there was no najas on them before. What about idol worshippers?
Likewise, the utensils of the idol worshippers is allowed to use because the Prophet did wudu from the utensil of a lady mushrik. He did wudu from her utensil. Okay, so it is allowed to use the utensils of the idol worshippers as long as, obviously, that utensil is not a religious act itself. For example, they have a certain cup which they offer to their gods. Obviously, we don't use that. And as long as that utensil is not made out of gold and silver, in other words, it fulfills the other criteria. But in general, yeah, if we know if we don't know that utensil to have been used for najasa, we're allowed to use those utensils.